The Community Character Hour is brought to you in part by the generous support of Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. Thanks to Lori, Clem, and all of you for supporting community radio in North Idaho. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah?
Today's article comes from the Pondere Review on October 7th of 1910. Last Wednesday afternoon, the blockings were knocked from the completed hull of the new steamer Western, which is being built by the Northern Navigation Company. And with majestic ease, she slid down the ways into the clear water with a splash that marked a new era in passenger service on Lake Pondere. She is 86 feet long, with a 12-foot beam, and equipped with 100 horsepower engines. Her boilers are of the Scotch marine type, and her carrying capacity will be 60 tons gross. She is built especially for passenger service and will accommodate 150 passengers. Donald Main, the builder, expects to have her in commission by November 1st, at which time she will take the Northern's regular run and the Northern will be tied up for repairs.
The Western sounds like quite a boat. Quite an impressive vessel. A ship, I guess we'd say. Not a boat.
Ooh.
I don't. Well, maybe we'll get into the difference. But didn't steamboats start, you know, crossing the lake well before 1910?
Well, that's a great question. So before Highway 95, before the Long Bridge, and before the railroad whistles echoed across Sandpoint, the water was our first freeway.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. I like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when this article was written in 1910, steamboats weren't nostalgic. They were still an essential mode of transportation. If you needed freight delivered, ore hauled, mail sent, or just travel across the lake, you waited for the steam. And in fact, the first steamboat on Lake Pondere was the Mary Moody, and that was built in 1866 at Senawakateen.
We first mentioned the Mary Moody in our episode about the trail to gold, the gold rush passing through this area. But people were crossing the river before that boat was built, right? Boat, ship, ferry, Mary Moody, before the Mary Moody was built.
I believe, Okay, someone will correct me if I'm wrong. I believe steamboats are considered boats. I know ferry
boats. It's a boat. Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm not sure if that has to do with them being a lake-going vessel versus an ocean-going vessel.
Mm. Yes.
I should have known this would come up.
You go on.
If only I were a true mariner.
Before the end of the episode, yeah. I'm going to find this out.
And then you have like steam, the word launch, steam launches, you know, like, which I think are little smaller vessels.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's based on length.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
does it have a hole?
Because there are ferries that go out to islands that are technically on the ocean, and ferries are always boats. But steamboats and tugboats, I don't know.
Mm.
A great mystery.
Let's see.
Jack's gonna solve.
Well, according to the. This one source, I think this is what the U.S. Navy uses. The term boat refers to a non-commissioned waterborne vessel that is not designated as a service craft. A boat is capable of limited independent operation. Officer/personnel boats, motor whale boats, and utility boats fit into this group. Boats carried aboard ship that can be hoisted from and lowered into the water are known as ship's boats.
Like a lifeboat?
Yeah.
Okay.
So a ship can carry a boat can't carry a ship.
Oh, interesting.
That's one.
Okay.
Okay.
Does it depend on like the shape of the hull as well?
I don't know about that.
It sounds like anything that floats with a motor.
Somebody
is, about,
somebody is okay. listening to this and just
they know
they're
screaming. yeah, I do think also there's I think right there where it says boat is capable of limited independent operation, which to I'm reading as basically
they're you not.
Can a one person can drive a boat.
And they're not commissioned by the military.
Yeah, and a ship requires a crew.
Gotcha.
They're throwing that one out there as a potential definition.
We have a lot of research to do.
Okay, back to it. What were we talking about? We're talking about boats on Lake Pend Oreille.
Yeah.
And ships.
And how people crossed the river before the Mary Moody was built. So for centuries, the region we now call Bonner County was navigated by Native Americans, including the Lower Kootenai, Kalispell, Flathead, Spokane, and Coeur d'Alene tribes. Traveling among seasonal hunting and gathering sites, they etched trails, some of which are still used today. But in many places, thick forests, heavy underbrush, and rough, rocky terrain hampered foot travel. Skimming over waterways in Salish sturgeon-nose canoes often proved quicker and easier travel than walking or riding on horseback. In the early 1800s, Western explorers such as David Thompson adopted these modes of canoe travel as they mapped out the areas and established trading posts. Then, starting in the 1860s, transportation needs multiplied practically overnight after gold was discovered in Canada and Montana. And we did talk about that in one of our previous episodes. Despite the burgeoning population traveling through the region, roads remained rough and primitive where they existed at all. Enterprising businessmen saw a need, and of course they filled it, constructing ferries and steamboats to keep everyone on the move.
Well, you're listening to the Community Character Hour, and we're talking about steamboats and ferries today. This is 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm here with Hannah Combs, the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus of that museum. Steamboats and ferries, a fascinating topic.
How we got around before the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick up where Hannah left off there.
Well, in the heyday of water travel, as many as 80 steamboats and 15 ferries shuttled passengers, livestock, timber, supplies, equipment, and mail across Bonner County's rivers and lakes. The steamer's whistle and the ferryman's hearty greeting were ordinary sounds for several decades. So one fun fact about this, so it was kind of like a big deal to be a steamboat captain, and each captain had its own like whistle sound. Ooh. So it was like a signature little toot, you know, that you had on the water, which I thought was really fun.
That is interesting because I've always wondered, I haven't been out on the lake that much, but when you see a vessel approaching in the distance, how do you know who it is? And I know there are things they have for safety, like the lights that they have on each side of the boat. And once you get close enough, you can read the name. But that's really cool that they had their own distinct whistle that could kind of alert you to who it is.
Yeah. And I always get excited when I see the mail lady pull up to my mailbox. Can you imagine seeing this beautiful boat kind of approach? And
well, and I don't know if everyone knows this, but there are still places on Lake Pend Oreille, especially in the winter, that can only be approached by boat. So on the east side of the lake, you know, Lakeview, Granite, Kilroy, towns like that, they still rely on a mail boat to get their mail in the winter.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. That is cool. I would like to take the mail boat sometime. Don't they let you ride along? I'm a journalist.
We're from the museum.
Yeah.
Can we hop on board, please?
Yeah. So what came first, the steamboats or the ferries? I mean, a steamboat sounds like a much bigger project than a ferry.
Well, great question and an expensive one. So before the gold rush increased demand, it didn't make sense to invest capital in a steamboat on a little traveled water system. So ferries definitely came first. And the first crossing was the Sinawatine.
Before the first ferry, how did they get across the river?
Well, it's likely that the Sinawatine was the most commonly used crossing because of shallower water and an easy approach on both sides of the river. So at certain times throughout the year, so this, of course, would not be during the spring runoff, the water may have been low enough to ford part of the way across.
Mm. According to Paul Recknitzer's book about Bonner County ferries, which is called Always on the Other Side, and is available at the museum gift shop if you're really interested in this topic. The very first informal ferries used at Sinawatine were probably canoes that they lashed together for stability. Because it could be hazardous for livestock and horses to swim across the river, logs could also be tied together to create a sort of barge that could be guided by oars. But this would have been pretty difficult to do depending on how strong the river current was at different times of year. Mm-hmm.
Sinawatine, I think I've got the pronunciation close to right. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's near Laclede.
Correct. Right? Yes. Yeah. It is on the south side of the Pendere River across mm-hmm. from Laclede. And yes, the town of Sinawatine no longer really exists, but there is still a cemetery there. And at that cemetery, you can see a lot of the names of some of the families that were there in the early days, which is really, really neat if you love local history.
This is getting off topic a little bit here, but Sinawatine, the first crossing, if you wanted to go either upriver or downriver and get across this, you know, the Pendere River system and the Clark mm-hmm. Fork, where was the next kind of nearest place to cross, do you know?
There are several places that you can or you could, and they did cross on the Pendere River. I mm-hmm. think the closest one would have been the Thema Ferry, which was between Laclede and Priest River. Mm-hmm. So that's another spot where the river narrows a little bit and there's kind of a soft sandy shore that you can approach from. So that was another ferry crossing site at one point. Mm-hmm. But there were several. Mm-hmm. Bridges didn't come until a lot later after roads were established. So those were kind of the only ways you could get across.
Yeah. So you need to get across the river. You're a traveler and you come up to the river. Is it then, if you arrive at Sinawatine, is it every man for himself and you just try to get across, or was there somebody there to help you out and take your gear and stuff?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, I imagine I'd stop, I'd try to find someone, some towns individual, and they're like, yes, it's, you know, 5 miles that way, and you want to do this, this, and that. But if you couldn't, it really, what you had to rely on your own creativity and use what materials you had from the shore. And that, you know, of course, that was just before the official ferry opened.
Aside from a relatively easy crossing, is there anything else that made the Sinawatine ferry so special?
Well, probably because it was an easy crossing, but the Sinawatine was at the crossroads of the most navigable, such a Monday morning, north, south, and east-west routes through Bonner County. So this ferry was not only the oldest ferry in Bonner County, but also the longest running. And it actually operated until 1957.
That's stunning to me.
Yeah.
That it was still running in 57.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have either of you taken a river ferry before?
I have. Well, I've over in Washington State.
Yes.
There's that one.
That's the one I did as well. Mm-hmm.
I have gone. Yes, I have used that to cross a river.
Nice.
It's very, very helpful. How about you?
I have crossed one on the Ohio River, and it's a fun little experience
to
drive your car on the little ferry. And then, of course, mm-hmm. we're neighbors to the big, sort of famous Canadian ferries that cross the lakes mm-hmm. up north of us here.
That's right. Yeah. I went up there once, and they were on strike. Oh, and I had to drive all the way back
down. That's a long drive.
Around the lake. A long, twisty, turny drive around the lake.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you haven't been mm-hmm. on a ferry before, you've got to try it out. It is quite an experience.
Yeah.
Um, Okay, so it was the ferry it ran until 1957. Mm-hmm. Shocking that it could still. This is after bridges at Priest River and at Sandpoint, mm-hmm. and there's still a ferry going right in between.
It's just so efficient and probably relatively inexpensive. It just kind of makes sense,
right? Yeah. I remember, you know, like being in on a college campus, and there would be sidewalks everywhere, right? But then there was always still the little like worn path that cuts diagonally through the quad because people just could. You have to take the most direct route, whether there's like a sidewalk there or not. I kind of feel like this is the same way. You know, if you live within a few miles of the ferry, it just makes sense.
It does, yeah. And especially with, Laclede at the time would have had, you know, would have been probably busier than it is today. Mm-hmm. You know, more people working and living there. I can see you don't want to drive all the way to Priest River to get on the other side of the river.
Well, and those were worn trails historically from, you know, the early Native American tribes, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Think about that, like also growing up, you know, near the forest and I had horses, I would just hop on my horse and take the deer trails.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so it's kind of fun to think about how animals and then people and everyone just kind of start to use the road, you know, that's most cultivated.
Right. Yeah. And how those trails and roads build on each other. I was reading something a while ago about how, like in the Midwest, Michigan area, some of the, you know, roads, the highways were built on old roads and the old roads were built on Native American trails, and the Native American trails were built on the, you know, migratory route of the mammoths from the Ice Age. And just thinking about how long some of these pathways have existed is just remarkable.
It really is.
I think that inspires me to maybe want to start the ferry again.
You'd be a great ferryman.
A
ferry at Laclede. I'll just stand and I'll take travelers across.
Will you have the bright yellow biking coat?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I'll wear my bright yellow coat.
And start with a canoe.
I have the canoe. I'll take you across. $10. Okay, this one that lasted till 1957 was also the oldest one. Correct. It was the first one there. Mm-hmm. Okay, when was the ferry at Saint-Aquitaine built, and who did it?
So exactly when the first commercial ferry began operating is not known necessarily and may not have been recorded. But one of the earliest records tells of a man named George Montour operating a ferry at Saint-Aquitaine in 1858. This account says, when on duty, he recorded that a government scout, W.T. Hamilton, crossed the river with 12 to 15 horses, 240 tanned buffalo robes, and a quantity of beaver, fisher, and marten pelts, for which he obtained $20 for ferry service.
$20 in 1858.
Yeah.
Which is sounds like a bit of a hefty fee for a ferryman to charge.
Yeah, that would be about $800 in today's money.
Okay.
But think about the value of his cargo at that time was approximately $3,500. Wow. All of those buffalo robes and beaver pelts, which would be about $135,000 today. So at that point in time, the ferryman, It might have seemed a fair price to keep his goods safe, and the ferryman also had a little bit of a monopoly on safe passage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing else is quite, well, nothing is guaranteed, even the ferry, but yeah, mm-hmm. nothing else seems quite as, you'd hate to try to be taking those,
because if they got damp, they'd be heavy, they'd likely wash away. You wouldn't want to put that on horses and make them swim across.
You're really at the mercy of how that gentleman was feeling at the time. The troll with the bridge. So a man of the name of Thomas Ford claimed to have operated the ferry after Montour gave it up, but it wasn't until 1863 that we had a reliable record of ownership. So the territorial legislatures of the time tried to enact a licensing procedure probably to restrain the overly ambitious entrepreneurs.
Standardize the pricing.
Right. This wasn't a large burden, though. Later in 1891, the operating license was still only $36. So someone like Montour could have paid the licensing fee in only a couple of trips.
Yeah. If he's charging people that much.
However, licensing was easier to legislate than it was to enforce. So in 1863, the Washington Territory issued a license for the Senoctane Ferry crossing to A.W. Compton and Henry Carnes. So Guy Haines sought a license from the Spokane County Commissioners, and the newly formed Idaho Territory legislator issued a license to Charles W. Fresh. So I think it's just one of these stories where, like, someone is like, okay, I'll do due process, but...
There's always the guy who follows the rules, yes, and then the guy who subverts the rules. Mm. So at this point in time, there are three people who have a claim to running this ferry, and none of these, the Idaho legislature at this time is in Lewiston. They're not coming all the way up here to check in on this. So these three guys must have been just haggling over who got first dibs on people coming across. And, the license is a good idea, but maybe a little ahead of its time.
Right.
So despite being the one without a legitimate license, Guy Haines seems to have outlasted his competition as he was the one running the ferry when the Mary Moody steamer was built at Senoctane in 1866. So this is where you kind of see the development of that river and lake travel. They were able to build the steamboat Mary Moody at Senoctane because they already had the ferry established there. And they were able to use that to help bring supplies up to that landing where they were building the steamboat. So Haines was running the ferry at that point in time. And after the mining rush calmed down several years later, he then passed the torch to a man named Richard Fry.
So it was around 1880, a man named Lyman Markham ran the ferry business, and he was followed by his brother Francis. The Markhams left such a mark on the waterways of Bonner County that we actually dedicate an entire upcoming show to their story.
Well, okay. We will look forward to learning more about the brothers Francis and Lyman Markham in a future edition of this program.
Indeed.
I'm excited.
It's super exciting. Such important individuals in our area. Huh. So as the local population swelled, so did the demand for ferries. At their peak, there were 15 ferries operating in Bonner County. The most heavily used were at Newport, Priest River, Laclede, and Clark Fork. So the typical ferry was a shallow drift barge made of logs propelled by either the current or, latter, a gasoline engine. In some cases, a cable stretched across the river, which kept the craft from drifting downward.
Now, this would probably only work, downstream of Senoctane, or downstream of wherever was the furthest point that they took the steamboats, because you wouldn't want a cable crossing the river if a steamboat was going to be crossing that same point.
Well, and then I think about, the biceps.
I'm hoping there was a good pulley system to help relieve some of
people
that
get creative tension. Fast.
Oh, yeah. If you have a problem, they figured out how to solve it.
So until the turn of the 20th century, most ferries were privately owned and operated, and you would pay a fee to the ferryman to cross. With the growth of traffic and the construction of better roads, the public began demanding free ferries.
To provide a free ferry, the county became the owner and operator of six crossings. And again, this is as we get into the later kind of era of the ferry boats, so into the 1900s. Ferrymen at this point were selected through competitive bidding, and the earliest salaries were about $60 per month, which was pretty good living. This was if you got one of these positions, you really tried to hold on to it. Free ferries were really only free of charge during normal working hours, which were from 6 a.m. until noon and from 1 p.m. until 7 p.m. So if you interrupted the ferryman's lunch or during other hours, there was a charge of 25 cents, except after dark when the charge was then doubled. So this wasn't particularly cheap if you came during outside hours or woke somebody
up. I mean, so you were always on the clock, hypothetically.
Yeah, always on call, like a doctor.
Yeah, you'd have to get out of bed.
Yeah.
Take your little stocking cap off.
Yeah. Go out in the blizzard. Yeah. That's what was going on. The ferryman was allowed to keep the tolls that he collected, but he was required to provide an annual bond to the county, usually about $500, which they think would have been considered a sort of performance bond to keep him operating at a high standard.
Meaning, okay. So he, yeah, if he doesn't come up with it, then maybe you got to find a different guy.
Yeah. So he's kind of paying a lease to the county to operate it, and then he gets to keep whatever income he makes on it.
Yeah.
I wonder if they, I don't know anything about this, but I wonder if they marketed their services at all, or if it was just that kind of you're in a pickle and you have to pay the ferryman. Mm-hmm. It's your only option.
Yeah. I think it was just something that everyone knew about, right? Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, probably. Yeah. So the ferryman was obligated to operate the ferry, like you said, 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. They never, it's like having a dairy farm. You never get a day off. To be available at all hours, the ferryman lived in a house located right next to the ferry landing. It was provided by the county and usually situated on the town side of the river. So some of these, a lot of these ferry crossings would have a sort of little community on one side, and then the other side would just be, you know, maybe a wagon road that would connect up to
the road going away.
The road, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. It was quite a position, I think. Like, you held a lot of power.
Oh, yeah. And think of the kind of social currency that you would collect as a ferryman. There are all kinds of stories of the ferrymen as sort of the gossip mongers of the county. Yes. They knew everybody's business.
I love that.
I wonder if it was, you know, on your 20-minute ferry crossing, if people just chatted to the ferryman, or if they asked like really probbing questions of everybody to collect information.
Yeah, definitely. He was like almost the chamber representative, like the first point of contact to the town.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I wonder who, and if there's six of them, are there people you're like, I'm gonna go out of my way so I don't have to talk to Bill.
Tom a little bit more.
That's right. Yeah.
It could also be sort of a public safety thing at times, though. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just mention to the ferryman, like, oh, my baby's sick. Mm. And then the ferryman has the doctor on the ferry a few days later. Mm-hmm. He's like, hey, maybe you should stop at so-and-so's house. The baby's sick. You should check in. Mm. They served a pretty important role socially.
When I think you may have said it already, but when did the county start operating the ferries, take over?
I don't know the exact year, but it was into the 1900s when that started. And a lot of this would have changed to, I'm guessing it would have been closer to the time when they were starting to build bridges and when they were starting to get more automobile traffic, that people were kind of expecting the ferries to be a free option, just like a bridge or a roadway would be. And to have those maintained and operated by the county rather than by individuals who could charge you whatever they wanted. It was considered sort of a public work at that point in time.
Yeah. Okay, where were we here? The ferryman lived in a little house on the town side of the river.
So in the early 20th century, motorized vehicles traveling on vastly improved roads and especially new bridges being constructed gradually made the ferries obsolete. I'm trying to remember the term, but it's called like they were essentially bridged out, right?
Yeah.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, well, that makes complete sense. Construction of the Long Bridge in 1908, the Priest River Bridge in 1916, and the Clark Fork Bridge in 1918 meant decommissioning the ferries, most of which were dismantled or quietly burned. I like that term.
Mm-hmm. Quietly burned. Mm-hmm. Peaceful.
Peaceful.
Burning. I do want to mention, though, if you go to the end of the road, if you're like heading toward the park in Laclede, but instead of turning right to drive down to the park, you go straight. There's the boat launch kind of dock there. If you peer over the end of the dock, at certain times, if the water's clear, you can see one of the sunken ferries
at the end of that dock.
Yeah.
Wow. It's really
neat. Oh, I love that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go check that out.
Yeah, for sure. The Newport Ferry, however, made a more spectacular exit in 1927. So at the public celebration of the opening of the Newport Bridge, ferryman Bill Gary ceremoniously put a torch to the craft and sent it flaming down the Pendere River. So it was like a Viking funeral.
Yeah, for the boat itself.
Yeah.
I do want to mention that this Bill Geary is not necessarily the gossipy Bill that you mentioned earlier.
Different ferryman Bill than my imaginary gossip Bill. Okay.
Clarity to that.
Okay. And let's hope this was in wintertime and he wasn't just sending a flaming boat down the river.
In the dead of summer.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, man. Kind of a side story, and I don't remember if I'll remember it all correctly, but there was such a big deal when the Newport Bridge was built. We now know the Idaho side of the river is known as Old Town.
Mm-hmm.
It was once known as Newport. And then Washington kind of stole its name once they built the bridge across. And they said, well, who are we then? And they're like, oh, you can be Old Town.
Oh.
And there was a whole big battle over who was supposed to pay for the bridge as well.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure governors got involved. It was pretty spicy.
This is all of this is happening before the construction of dams. Almost all of this is happening before the dams controlling the flow of the river. And that I'm trying to admit, like, having a ferry at Newport now would be like impossible. It seems to me, with the river that moves pretty fast underneath. I mean, it's both low. Well, I don't know. It fluctuates, I guess, because of the dam. It goes up and down. And but picturing, like, knowing that we've got the Albany Falls there, which is now a dam, I would think that river would be moving pretty quickly as it heads through Newport, but
it would,
I don't know.
Depend. Yeah, there could potentially be more volume, but sometimes that makes it move more slowly. I think with the dams, they really were able to get more predictable flows.
But that's when you had like the ferryman would be the expert on all things like water and movement.
They would know the currents. Yeah. They would know the river. I'm imagining, you know, living several miles downstream of Newport and just seeing this flaming boat coming down the river. You're probably panicking that someone's in dire distress.
Yeah.
Unless you got the word.
Yeah.
Hopefully they alerted the neighbors.
Just thinking of like these ferries, you know, it's hard not to picture them operating on the river as we know it today, which is pretty calm. Yeah. I mean, it flows.
Thanks to the dams.
Yeah, thanks to the dams. Mm-hmm. But in these days, it would be going at times, I think it would be moving very fast and times. Not so much. I don't know.
Yeah. And there are places like Albany Falls before the dam. There would have been pretty big rapids there.
Yeah.
So there were definitely at times of the year more more things to look out for, more big rocks potentially.
Yeah.
Log jams, hazards like that.
And the Priest River itself, I mean, having a crossing there, but that's where the Priest River flows into the Pendere River, I think would be. Seems like that'd be tricky waters to navigate, but I don't know.
I should know this. I I would have to look this up to be certain. I don't think there was a ferry crossing right at the mud hole, right at the outlet of the Priest River, because they used that so much for logging.
Yeah.
They would have been doing log runs down the Priest River into the Pend'Oreille River.
Yeah.
So that would have been a pretty dangerous spot for
a little
for a ferry crossing.
Further downstream at where the bridge is now, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm speculating entirely. I have no idea.
I need my fairy book. I know.
I forgot it.
Such a good book.
Yeah, it is. Yes, thank you for loaning me that
Wouldn't
copy.
You say it is one of, like, it is the premier reference for fairies?
Oh, in
like,
Bonner County, absolutely.
That you all, like, did a whole reprint of it?
We did, yes. So we recently brought this book back into print.
So it's amazing.
It's by Paul Rechnitzer, and he spent several years, many years actually, researching every single fairy. There are about 15 of them.
So amazing.
I wish I knew all of their histories off the top of my head, but I'm still learning. So,
good read.
Yeah, it's. I mean, even if you're not that interested in like fairies as an idea, but just if you're interested in kind of the history of the lake and where
travel.
Where people were and how they got around, it's cool. Okay, where were we? So we have a flaming boat heading down the heading down the river, left leaving Newport and heading further into Washington State. Good riddance, I say, and that's the end of the ferry era. So this
part of the rivalry, like a flaming, like that's like a kind of a middle finger.
Let's see.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't know.
If the Seine-Aquitaine to Laclede ferry operated until the 1950s, that means that ferries were a reliable mode of transportation for about 100 years in Bonner County. So we have to move on now to the other topic we were going to discuss, steamboats. How did steamboats fare in comparison? Can you take us back to the Mary Moody?
Yes. So she's the start of it all.
Mm-hmm.
So in quite a sight to behold in 1866. So she was 108 feet long.
Wow.
She weighed 85 tons and was constructed from timber whipsawn. That was actually from the site of Seine-Aquitaine. So she was built there. And her machinery was hauled in on a steamboat from Portland, Oregon, and then a mule and ox team from Walla Walla.
And we did talk about how that kind of all started in one of our earlier episodes. Trying to connect the steamboat routes.
Yeah. And at that time, you think about, so if there's Spokane, but so much was coming from Portland, Oregon, in terms of this how large the city was, the industry over there, and the connectivity.
Any specialized equipment would either be made there or even imported from the East Coast and then brought around up to Portland or Vancouver.
And I might have be talking at a turn, but as I recall, the machinery came from like a different steamboat too.
Yeah, nothing was wasted.
Yeah.
And I don't know the specifics of the Mary Moody, but when boats like this were decommissioned, they typically stripped anything of value off of it before the boat was torn apart or sunk or anything like that. So pretty much any metal machinery would have been taken and reused on another boat if it could be.
So it always had a continuous life force, just kind of with maybe a new package and a different name. Mm-hmm. So on her maiden voyage, the Mary Moody carried 25 pack animals, 10,000 pounds of freight, and 50 passengers across a long route towards the Cabinet Mountains. So she proved something powerful to those who had struggled to pack their horses along the shores of the lake. Water was much faster, it was more efficient, and it meant so much more opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't just transportation, they were essential infrastructure.
Exactly. The mining boom depended on boats, and not only during the Kootenai Gold Rush of the 1860s. In 1890, Bonner County had its own mining boom. Though not gold, it was silver, lead, zinc, and copper. Those minerals were all discovered near Hope, Garfield Bay, Clark Fork, and Priest River. So the chloride gulch near Lakeview saw a 250,000 smelter construction, and the Tallachy mine eventually produced over 2 million ounces of silver.
I never realized that. That's a lot of... I didn't think any of our mines produced much of value. Mm-hmm. I didn't know we had a successful silver mine
crazy?
Here.
Yeah. So it was like British Columbia had the gold, but then all of a sudden, you know, our stock of materials here.
Yeah.
Chloride Gulch near Lakeview. Mm-hmm. Is there any...
I love the name.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. well, we got to... we'll ask about that on some... We're talking about boats this time. We're not talking about mining. But how was the ore... How did they get the ore out from the other side of the lake where they had found this... where they had found Chloride Gulch and other mining areas?
Well, that was, of course, by steamboat.
Aha!
So the boat Pondere...
Spelled just, like the
yeah,
city.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So maybe, right? Mm-hmm. Towed ore to the Panhandle Smelter in Sandpoint. The Bluebell hauled freight from the mining companies. And the Dora Powell hauled cement barges from Lakeview to the railroad at Bayview. Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to bring this up. Many of the beautiful old historic buildings in Spokane have foundations poured using cement mined here on Lake Pend Oreille.
Amazing. We built the infrastructure. You're welcome. Mm-hmm. So without steamboats, there could have been no mining boom. And without mining, Sandpoint would have grown from its tiny railroad siding.
Yeah.
So thank you, steamboats, right? Yeah.
I imagine they were also pretty important to the logging industry in some way.
That's right. Logging especially. So the fresh cut logs were floated into massive rafts chained together with boom chains. And then steam tugboats hauled those rafts up and down Priest Lake, the Pend Oreille River, and Lake Pend Oreille to the lumber mills. So I have to tell you, in one of our yard selling ventures, my husband, and I think he did this without me knowing. So he's loading up this ginormous chain with like a hook. Uh-huh. And it's one of the boom chains from the 1800s from the mills that someone had found.
Yeah.
And it will belong to the museum, of course, but like I can't even pick it up. It's so heavy and it's all like hand done, but he was so proud of himself.
That's like, a good find.
What are we going to do with this?
Oh man, I know we have one in the Markham exhibit that you curated that every now and then will kind of slide off of its perch and I get to pick it up and I'm like, oh, one link of this chain probably weighs 10 pounds. This is an enormous.
You probably don't want another one.
We just might need a few more people to help carry it.
So were these boats basically all used for industry or were they used for, you know, pleasure craft as well?
Mm. Oh, yes. So at the turn of the century, they became floating ballrooms.
Oh, I love that.
I think those are some of my favorite photos from the collection. Uh-huh. So the Northern ran daily between Sandpoint and Hope. On Saturday night, its captain wound up the Victrola and turned on the upper deck into a dance floor. And then the Eagle made weekly circuits around the lake and was described as the finest passenger boat on the lake.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine? Like, this would be, I still think of Sandpoint as a town where there aren't many occasions to dress up. You know? And I think at this point in time, it would have been the same way. Uh-huh. You'd be like, I'm just doing tours all the time. You know, aside from going to church, I never get a chance to dress up. But this would be that chance. You get to go to a dance on a boat.
Yeah.
At night on the lake.
Amazing. And then this is like totally a whole like side rabbit hole that I'm going to take us down. But there was a lot like so gambling. Mm-hmm. And then wasn't there like something where there were these like gambling boats?
Okay, I was hoping we could get into this. I feel like this is a little bit of speculation, but we have a cash register at the museum.
So good.
That was dredged up from the lake. It definitely, it looks like one of those, you know, things in the movie Titanic that they pulled up. It's just encrusted with rust. You can barely tell what it is. But it's definitely a cash register. And so for years, I've wondered, why was this in the lake? It had to have fallen off a boat. But what kind of boat would have had a full-size cash register on it? And why?
Yeah.
So
I mean, I definitely think there were boats of entertainment, and I'm like obsessed with like the Thin Man series, and they would go on these like excursions where there'd be like a whole nightlife on the boat, and there'd be gambling, and yeah. So I just like I have this fantasy that that was like totally happening.
And I guess my fantasy would be that. This was during Prohibition.
Yes.
And they got raided and they're like, throw the evidence overboard. Mm-hmm. This is all pure speculation.
This is,
but it's a good story.
This is what happens when oral history raid.
Yeah.
So hopefully we have some callers that can confirm that or deny it. But the Pendere carried. So this is another, the name of a steamboat. So it carried 125 members of the Elks Club, like the IOOF Lodge, on a Sunday excursion to Idlewild in 1901. So even President Theodore Roosevelt rode the Northern during a 1912 visit. So for a time, steamboats were not just commerce. They actually were part of the community.
But it couldn't last forever.
No, boats wrecked, boats burned, steamboats that had outlived their usefulness were destroyed by their owners. Such was the case with the Nancy, which was rammed and sunk by her owner when her hull decayed beyond repair. I think this was just a fun excuse for a bunch of guys. Maybe a case of beer.
Light the boat on fire, sink it, fill the hole with rocks.
Hey, Ted, we're all going out. Other vessels were burned or dismantled. Sometimes parts were salvaged and installed on other boats, too, which we had talked about.
Yeah, I would say that happened whenever possible, unless it was an accidental sinking in deep water, because you just wouldn't want to have to order new machinery when you had stuff you could reuse.
Yeah, exactly. In 1937, when the Western, which was a sister ship to the Northern that we had discussed at the earlier part of the show, was burned down during the Great Depression, it actually marked the end of the steamboat era on Lake Pendere. So in the earliest 20th century, improved roads, motorized vehicles, and new bridges, such as the Long Bridge, gradually phased out the need for ferries and steamboats. Today, steamboats cruise the same...
Speedboats, right?
I think I'm fantasizing.
I wish they were still here.
If we had steamboats. Speedboats, thank you, Hannah, cruise the same waters which once were churned by sternwheelers. But there was probably still some old-timers around the area who remember when steamboats had that beautiful whistle which floated across the water as a common as a bird song and just as sweet. Oh, little special. Mm-hmm. Whistles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I always think of like Mississippi with the big, you know, the churning of the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The paddle boats.
The paddle boats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we had kind of a little bit of everything on this lake.
Yeah.
In terms of different types of steamboats and tugboats. And, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Special little launches.
As far as you had the paddle wheel. Mm-hmm. The one in back, the stern wheeler. Mm-hmm. What about the side wheeler?
I don't know about the side wheeler.
Okay. Wow.
No? Well, maybe we did. Who knows? And then, of course, there were the ones with propellers, the screws. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We have the anchor from a boat called the Coyote is on display on the lawn of the museum. So
that's the one right
outside. Kind of a fun one to come next time you're at the museum, come visit. And I think the anchor will help give you a scale of the size of these boats.
Yeah.
So if you've seen our big yellow caboose, that's about, probably 40 to 50 feet long. Mm-hmm. So some of these boats were more than four times as long as the caboose.
Gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that anchor is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just to think of like, yeah, what size vessel would require this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's neat to think about. Okay.
So, and if you want to see one of these boats still, the only one I know of and have seen is up by, it's in Caslow, BC. They actually have one of these boats that's been restored and turned into a museum on their lake up there.
Oh, so cool.
So you take the ferry to get up that direction, and then you can drive along the highway and visit the steamboat museum.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of our journey into the era when water was our highway.
And then, and they just, economics forced them out of business, I guess. It no longer was viable
to run. Bridged out.
Yeah, bridged out.
Wasn't the most efficient or
you can now
cheap
take,
way to travel.
Take a car to most of the places, some of the places.
But just think, like, just with, like, the automobile, the impacts that it had to do with, like, the horse and wagon, like, all of these different jobs and industry are just, like, completely gone.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how many people had to innovate or pivot to work with the new thing. So I think right now in history, a lot of people are feeling that with technology. You know, things are changing all the time, but this was the time where transportation was kind of going through the same big bursts of change.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to give a special thank you to Olivia Luther, who was a former director of the museum, and Paul Rucknitzer, again, for their research that formed the basis of today's program. It was quite a help to have knowledgeable people doing the heavy lifting on researching all of these old boat, not ship, records, we think.
Absolutely.
Heather, what are we going to talk about next time?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's go ahead and dive right into the little tickle in the next episode, which would be the man Bonner County was named for. So that would be E.L. Bonner of Bonner's Ferry.
Yeah. We'll go a little bit outside of Bonner County to give some context on this man's life.
Yeah. I'd like to think that at one time we were all kind of one.
We were. Actually, truly, at this point in time, we were part of the same county.
Yeah. Learning about the namesake of our county. Mm-hmm. Okay. And another ferryman, I assume.
You assume. Yes. We shall find out.
We'll find out. Okay. Okay, real quick, we got to talk about upcoming events. We got to talk about last time I saw you, Hannah. It was in the museum. You were standing dressed like you were about to go out on an Arctic expedition of some kind. The museum was empty, and you were going to go. It looked like maybe you were going to go snowblow or something. This was during the big. The biggest snow of the year.
The one snow we got.
What were you preparing for?
We just opened our latest exhibit curated by Olivia Fee, our curator. It is called For the Record, How Journalists, Surveyors, and Photographers Shaped History as We Know It Today. So it's a really fun kind of dive into our archival collection of maps, photographs, newspapers, and kind of talks about how our history is recorded and how we're then later able to use these records, and how, you know, some people, like the folks who write our newspapers, are doing their work with the intention that people will be able to look back on it and understand the past through their words. And others, like a lot of our photographers, are sort of accidental historians. Mm. You know, they may not realize when they're taking beautiful photos how important they'll be to our historic record. So it's really fun. We are open Tuesdays through Fridays from 10 to 4. And the first Saturday of each month from 10 to 2. And on those first Saturdays, admission is free. The next one is on March 7th. And that free first Saturday is sponsored by Sand Creek Custom Wear. So stop by then if you can't stop by during the week to see the new exhibit. We would love to show you around. We also have a couple of exciting events coming up in the next few weeks. This coming Saturday, February 28th, if you're listening to this live, the museum is partnering with the Panada Theater to show Eric Darstead's film Sandpoint at the North End of the Long Bridge. This was created for Sandpoint's centennial back in 2001, and this year marks Sandpoint's 125th anniversary. So we are sharing the film again. It'll be a fun little look back into not just the 2001 era, but also hundreds of years of Sandpoint's history. It's a great film, whether you are new to town. It's a great introduction to this place and why it's so special. If you've been around for ages, it's also a really fun, nostalgic look back on the way the town once was. And I'm thrilled. On March 14th, we're doing a very special program. That is a Saturday. We're going to be doing a sort of adventurous hiking tour of the Pendere Bay Trail. And we have a special guest who will be leading that tour, Steve Gill, recently retired environmental consultant who did quite a bit of research when they were cleaning up the Black Rock site, which was where the Panhandle Smelting Company was that we mentioned briefly in this episode. He did all of the research and history on that entire stretch of our shoreline. So he's coming up from Coeur d'Alene and is going to give a tour of the Bay Trail. We're going to walk all the way out to the end and get to see the remains of the Humbird Lumber Mill and the smelter and everything in between. So again, that's the morning of Saturday, March 14th. We have not released tickets yet, but they are going to be limited. So keep an eye out for that.
That would be very cool.
What fun.
What if it snows?
So
putting on your suit? You going out there?
Steve and I are really excited about this. We're going rain, snow, whatever the weather is. So be aware. It could be a little adventurous. This is a join at your own risk.
Dress
be prepared for whatever might occur.
Okay.
Oh, I love it.
Well, it's 9 o'clock. Our time is at a close. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Jack.
Another fun episode learning about steamboats.
As always.
Okay, we'll see you next month. Thanks for listening to the Community Character Hour on 88.5 KRFY Pend Oreille.